for bringing that to our attention. One of you kindly pointed out at the end of the last lecture that I said something that was really not very accurate at all. I'm almost a little embarrassed about it. I referred to Professor Oglesby and his talking about, this is not his term, my term, the first settlers in this area. And one of you quite rightly pointed out that this area has been inhabited for many hundreds and thousands of years, and the white settlers were not the first settlers. My apologies. That's the kind of thing where it's extremely helpful when you, if you hear me say something like that, to call it to my attention. It was not an apt phrase, and I think we have to expand our horizons to and to be more accurate. That simply was inaccurate. Thanks again, Barb.
Thank you.
I'm going to continue today with the thinking about nature. We have been talking about the desacralization of nature and how this both resulted in a certain liberation for human beings and also made it psychologically more nearly possible that we could beat up on our natural environment. And I stress, among other things, how culture, to a considerable extent, is a pulling away from nature, a defining of humans more in terms of reasoned thought, in terms of art and music and literature, and perhaps most of all, simple speech. We are what some writers have called the chattering species. And I mentioned the fact that we talk so much, we chatter so much, because we are really trying to find out who we are and how we ought to live, how we want to live. And thus, conversation becomes so basic in human existence. One of the more interesting pieces that's been written on the subject of humans and nature is a little piece by Leo Marx, M-A-R-X, Leo Marx, called Pastoral Ideals and City Troubles. It was written back in 1968 and first appeared in the Smithsonian Annual 2. Marx is the author also of The Machine and the Garden, a book where he deals with, at greater length, with some of the same themes. Marx discusses what he refers to as the retreat into the country, the desire of city people to get away from the hustle and bustle and the hyper-civilization of the city. And he says that this movement in space typically is served to represent a movement of the mind and spirit, a quest for a new and happier way of life. And he believes that a proper understanding of the literary landscape that he finds plays a fairly significant role in American literature particularly, quote, could help us in planning the future of the actual landscape. And I'm going to give a lecture later in the semester that will build precisely on some of these insights, where I'll talk about a very practical issue, our control of highway corridors and building along highway corridors, and show how this kind of thinking in the humanities provides some of the base for that. Marx refers to what he calls observed regularities in American literature and describes what he calls, quote, an ideal type of a familiar symbolic landscape. This symbolic landscape, he tells us, quote, characteristically has three sectors, a community, a village, town, or city, a partly developed middle ground, neither urban nor wild, and thirdly, wilderness. City, wilderness on the opposite extreme, and in between the pastoral, the rural, the partly developed area. And he notes that this symbolic landscape does not serve merely as a backdrop or setting, that it is intricately related to these various pieces of literature. He's thinking of things like Thoreau's Walden, Melville's Moby Dick, Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn, some of Hemingway's and Faulkner's work, and so on. And he says in the best-known American fables, and he's thinking of precisely some of the ones I've mentioned, Thoreau, Melville, Mark Twain, the symbolic landscape is inseparable from the action or narrative structure, which may be divided into three movements: the retreat, the exploration of nature, and the return. The retreat, the exploration of nature, and thirdly, the return. First, the retreat. That is the retreat from the city or from civilization. And he says that the action begins with the hero narrator's withdrawal from a relatively complex, organized community, often a community from which he has been alienated. He's looking for a different way of life. There's a withdrawal from the city or from the what is sometimes experienced as the the excessive pressures of the city and of culture and civilization. Second, and this is the central movement, according to Marx, the hero, quote, explores the possibility of a simpler, more harmonious way of life, end quote, within the middle ground or the pastoral. The belief, the hope, the anticipation that if you could just get away from the pressures of the city, from the noise and the confusion and all the expectations into this pastoral setting, that somehow life might be better. Marx notes that the possibilities of a simpler, more harmonious way of life beyond the borders of ordinary society, as he says, prove to be limited. And two characteristic kinds of episode, he notes, help to define these limits. The first is what he calls the interrupted idyll, I-D-Y-L-L, not I-D-O-L, I-D-Y-L-L, the interrupted idyll. He says, and I quote, "The peace and harmony of the retreat into the middle landscape is shattered by the sudden, often violent intrusion of a machine or of a force or person closely associated in the figurative design with a new industrial power." The locomotive was one of the chief examples that he uses, and the feelings people had towards the locomotive when it first began to be commonly used. On the one hand, great pride, a sense of achievement, obvious appreciation of the fact that you could travel easier and further and safely and so on. But on the other hand, this feeling that one was being invaded, that this pastoral idyll, this leisure, this quiet was being destroyed by this interloper from civilization. And indeed, his book, The Machine in the Garden, develops this theme at much greater length. So the interrupted idyll, the sudden intrusion, the violent intrusion of the machine was one of the defining limits. The second characteristic limiting episode, Marx writes, quote, occurs when the narrator's retreat carries him close to or into untouched, untrammeled, and though his exposure to the wilderness often proves and though his exposure to the wilderness often proves to be a spiritual tonic, evoking an exhilaration and sense of freedom, it also arouses fear. This is found in this mainstream of American literature, and I think to some extent it's muted for us today, because when we go into wilderness today, we take so much of civilization with us. We take freeze-dried fruits, foods and all kinds of high-tech gear, and increasingly when people get into some extremely dangerous areas, they take their cell phones sometimes. And so wilderness does not have the same threatening feeling that
that it did, I think, when we're looking back even 100 years or so, because it's a different kind of experience. Although even today, if any of you have been out in a sailboat or something when a sudden squall came up, I've had the experience of once losing the rudder on a sailboat, and I was fairly near shore and being pushed inexorably towards a very rocky shoreline. And that fear is very real. So he speaks, on the one hand, the intrusion of the machine. On the other hand, this sense of exhilaration that one gets from moving further into the wilderness, but also the arousal of fear. Mark says, for this individual soon comes to realize that an unchecked recoil from civilization may destroy a person. Either in the sense of extinguishing his uniquely human traits, or in the quite literal sense of killing a person. He says the hero, quote, discovers in short that there are two hostile forces which impinge from opposite sides of the symbolic landscape upon the garden-like scene of his retreat. One is the expanding power of civilization and technology. The other is the menacing anarchy of wild nature. Civilization, routine, rationalization of everything threatens our spontaneity, threatens the joy of living. But on the other hand, going too far into the wilderness, one senses how vulnerable one actually is as a person. And so this leads to the third movement, that he refers to, namely the return. The retreat into nature, the interruption, the interrupted idol, and finally the return. Marx writes that, quote, our sophisticated writers of pastoral are virtually unanimous in their emphasis upon the limited value of such withdrawals from the world. Retreat is useful only if temporary. It is, to use Robert Frost's well-known description, quote, a momentary stay against confusion. A momentary stay against confusion. If unchecked, Marx writes, quote, the pastoral impulse can lead to disaster. It leads the protagonist into the dark woods or that swamp of instinct and uncontrolled feelings, whereas Hemingway's hero senses, referring to Nick Adams in Big Two-Hearted River, the fishing, quote, will be tragic. Marx claims that the significance of this literary design is primarily subjective. It refers chiefly to the inner, not the external landscape. And I think this is part of the power of this analysis. In part, what we're talking about is not just city, pastoral and wilderness. We're talking about spaces or zones within our own experience. In Freudian terms, ego in the middle, superego, and id, where we experience in ourselves that there needs to be a certain balancing between the kind of over-controlling constant pressure from the superego to conform, to live by the rules, to do everything exactly right, to succeed and fulfill parents' expectations and so on. And on the other hand, the experience that if we overthrow these constraints too fully, if we want to escape from all of this and just submerge ourselves in sexual experiences or wild drinking or drug use or whatever, that can be a very scary and frightening and costly experience as well. So that the human condition, in a way, is finding that kind of balance. From antiquity, Aristotle, Socrates, all the great religious and philosophical and literary thinkers, I think, have said much the same thing. To find that balance between, in Freudian terms, superego and id, the balance mediated by the ego. If you cut yourself off too far from some of the more chaotic impulses and so on, your life becomes overly sterile and ordered and
and somewhat anemic. If you go too far into those kinds of experiences, they can destroy you. And that, in a way, is the human predicament. And there are no simple, foolproof algorithms or rules for how you mediate that. The traditional wisdom of the ages gives us a lot of clues. This is part of the great power of literature, is we read great novels and see how others have attempted it, how they foundered in this direction and foundered in that direction, and where it all comes out. We don't have to experience all of this in our own lives, because it's too costly to keep reinventing the wheel. But I think that's part of the power of the actual landscape as it interacts with the subjective landscape, is because, in a way, the city does represent for us that more ordered superego type of aspect of our existence, and in a way, wilderness does represent the other. It's both beautiful and awe-inspiring and enticing, but it's also scary, because it can destroy us. We have the experiences of the American mountain men, for instance, who worry deeply about losing their core humanity, resorting to cannibalism under stress and fearing that they would lose what it meant to be a human being. As Wayne Booth says, we ourselves created in a field of selves. There's no such thing as a totally autonomous, isolated individual, because you don't even learn to speak or think as a human being apart from the social context. And yet that same social context can become oppressive, can feel too restrictive in some situations, and the temptation is to go too far in the other direction. Any thoughts or comments before I move on to the next section? It's a very nice analysis, and I think has very interesting implications, as I'll try to show later in the semester, for how we plan the actual physical landscape. I'm going to argue that the feeling is fairly universal that we ought not to let urban functions just bleed out all over the countryside through the pastoral into the wilderness. And I think it's one of the reasons much of America has become so ugly, is because we haven't understood that when you let urban development just follow our highways ad nauseum, so that you never sort of leave the city, people find that aesthetically and emotionally less attractive than, say, what you find in parts of Germany and English countryside and Switzerland, Austria, and other parts of the world where they keep these more distinct. Question or comment?
Yeah, when was this written?
I think the date here was 1968.
It's describing to a tea, like white light.
I think it could, although that started, I don't know if I would say white light, because that urbanization process, suburbanization, really started earlier, and also it included black life, because blacks and Hispanics had left the inner cities at about the same rate, in some cases, as whites when they were financially able to. So I don't know if I would refer to it just as white flight. I need to check that, but I think it was just at the beginning of the period when cities were becoming much, much less safe. And people were beginning to find cities dangerous places to live. But, you know, it's hard today to imagine what it was like in some other periods or some other parts of the world when cities were really pretty safe. Kids in the 30s and 40s, early 50s, kids 10, 12 years old used to go across town in New York City for music lessons in the subway, and parents didn't worry about them. And even I, as a kid in Syracuse, which is now quite crime-ridden, we went all over the place. So, yeah, I think that a lot of factors contributed here. Did you want to say more on that?
Well, I mean, it just seems like it's a really elaborate justification, because it's so much easier to say, oh, well, we have this pastoral impulse ingrained in us, rather than, you know, it's so much easier to say that than, hey, I'm racist.
I don't know how it would tie in with racism, because what Marx is really talking about are literary works that are, you know, 100 years old in some cases, 50 years old. They're much older than the kind of flight from the city that we've seen maybe in the last 40 years. But it'd be good. This is the kind of thing I'd encourage you to, you know, talk about in discussion session. Is that one of the factors? I think it probably represents something more of a human desire for safety, for a certain contact with nature and so on, because my guess is if you take areas like suburban Washington, D.C., most minority people who have the money have left the inner city too, because they just find it too unsafe and too difficult. So if you take a lot of the towns like Reston, Virginia, and Columbia, Maryland, and a lot of these suburban areas, there is a middle class presence of blacks and others that's, you know, perhaps percentage wise not all that different from whites. Yes?
Well, ultimately, I mean, I think that if you are in sort of a social mindset where you're living in the city and it's always been sort of a safe environment for you, and then all of a sudden strange, oddly colored people start moving in. You know, it's like people, you know, and while this is certainly not the sort of mindset that we think of today, and it certainly is on one level racist, it's sort of almost understandable that one would feel discomforted by that if one had a different mindset, and that would be sort of part of an instinct to move to maybe a safer, more calm place, if that was a stress factor.
Well, it's possible, and these are extraordinarily difficult things. I find myself that employing terms like racism today has really run out of steam. That it's a rather useless explanation in most places, because what happens is that when there has been the kind of deterioration that there is in many inner city environments and so on, and when there are hugely discrepant rates of crime, say among whites and blacks, roughly 6 to 8 times as much crime committed by black males between 16 and 30 as white males, people develop fears. And my sense is that much of the talk of racism today is because of two factors. Because there's a racist industry, people who make their living by fanning the flames of racism, mostly in universities and social service settings. And then there's a lot of white guilt that I think is solved by talking about racism. I don't think that factor, as many black conservatives now are arguing, is very fruitful anymore. I think today we've got to stop talking so much about victimization and racism and start talking about what would actually change the situation in terms of better schools and things like this. And as I'll suggest later in the semester, it's very, very interesting to me that both Republicans and Democrats have their whipping boys and their favorite issues, but on things like education, in spite of all the flack he gets, it seems to me that Bush and the Republicans are on much stronger ground than the Democrats, because they're pushing for school choice and ways of giving people an option in very, very difficult situations. So I guess I would be one person who thinks that we ought to call a kind of moratorium on so much talk about racism, because I think Americans are not that racist anymore. I think this is a term that is used to cover what are much deeper problems in how people relate to each other. They're very, very tough issues. And one of the tragedies in a place like Cornell is you seldom hear points of view like my own. The university is so one-sided in many of the key departments that there's a kind of massive censorship in terms of points of view that you hear. But there's quite a few people who believe that where we really need to focus on some of these issues, for instance, would be in terms of the family, in terms of family structure and values, and that racism itself is not that critical a factor anymore. I don't know. I'm wondering. Any other comments back on the
issue? Okay.
They're tough issues, but I think what Marx is talking about really is something more basic in our experience that probably is more cross-cultural. That people from, I think, many cultures and many times have felt the oppression and pressures of the city. And I would say that I think, as Marx argues, it's to some extent the psychological pressures that we feel internally. The pressure to perform, to produce, to do it all by the rules. And then it seems to me the temptation is to go to the other extreme.
My point was just that xenophobia can be a stressing factor. Right?
Of course, of course. And I think that we are experiencing that. And admittedly, we all see these issues in far less than objective terms. It's very, very hard to escape the beliefs and values that you were brought up with, even when that's desirable to do so. Any other comments before we go on? Okay, yes.
Just a question on your perspective.
Yeah.
I mean, don't you think that as an elder, a life professor at a prestigious university, that you're not necessarily exposed to where racism might be occurring, and that your kind of blanket statement is maybe a bit
Let's take a specific issue like profile. This is the racial or ethnic profile. Among academics today, this is really taboo. You shouldn't racially profile. You shouldn't ethnically profile. But let me give you an example. All rational people sexually profile. You do it to survive, because if you're walking down the street at night in a bad neighborhood where the crime rates are high, the chance of a male attacking you, particularly if you're a woman or if you're a man, are 10, 20 times greater than a female. So if you're at all rational, you sexually profile. You're more careful when you see a man coming towards you when you're all alone and vulnerable than you are a woman. Now, the tragedy, and this is the kind of thing that people don't want to talk about, is it also is rational to racially profile. Because the chances in many areas of the country of a black male attacking you are about 6 to 8 times greater than a white male. And that's just a fact of life. Now, instead of talking about racism, it seems to me, why don't we talk about what's really causing this situation? Because it really would be racist to think that it has something to do with being black or being white. What it has to do with are factors that are causing people to act that way. And it seems to me that what narrows the discussion so that it becomes very unfruitful at many places like Cornell is we don't have an open discussion. Most of what you'll hear at a place like Cornell is that this is caused by poverty or by bad schools and so on. That's partly true. But the best social science data suggests that probably the chief factor is the breakdown of family structure. That when you have between 65 and 70% of all black children today born outside of marriage, and in many cases growing up without supportive males, the results are disastrous. But instead of talking about that, we talk constantly about racism. And I think that this is unfair to everybody in health. I think it becomes sociologically and scientifically inaccurate. And I think it becomes socially unproductive. And I think a lot of this conversation is a ploy or a maneuver that whites make in order to assuage their guilt feelings. And I don't think it helps people very much. And interestingly, a significant number of very, very prominent black writers are saying the same thing. Well, we don't hear them at Cornell. We don't invite them to speak at Cornell because their solutions to these problems don't fit the political correctness at a place like Cornell. And that means simply they're not getting a very good education on these issues.
And I would add to your scenario with a woman walking down the street alone.
Yeah.
That
or a man walking alone.
To make the distinction between a black male and a white male, I mean, I think they're both present a significant threat.
Of course.
Equally.
Of course.
And, but to choose, well, this white person doesn't look threatening, I don't have to look like
well, your term equally, though, is not borne out. The incidence of violent crime by black males is 6 to 8 times higher per capita. And one takes that seriously.
Well, I'm not sure where your statistics are lying out. Maybe that's, you know, it's such a, you know, violent crime has been on the decrease in this country for a long time.
That's right.
And so it's maybe at the point where that 6 to 8 times that you refer to is perhaps dated or is not interpreted correctly. Because there could be a difference, but maybe it's not a significant difference.
I grant that. In other words, these...
If you watch the, like, the nightly news and say a deep urban area like L.A., for example, that proportion that you're talking about is not represented in the amount of black, the amount of violence that's shown on TV. The media will intensely focus on black violence.
Let me give you a nice example.
On the fears of people like us who live on the fringe, live in suburbia, who aren't, just sit back on our laurels and look, oh my God.
Let me give you a nice example that bears out your point. The L.A. riots, what, 6, 8, 10 years ago, I forget, I lose track of dates. These were not basically race riots at all. The media presented these as a black uprising and Hispanic uprising, but the more careful analysis showed these weren't racial or ethnic uprisings at all. They were basically thugs, white, black, Hispanic, who took advantage of this situation and started burning and looting and so on. And the media really lied to us about that uprising. It wasn't basically black and Hispanic. It was white, black, and Hispanic criminal types who really took this occasion to go on a rampage. And so in part, that may be right. And one of the things we need in cases like that is very much more accurate news reports. So that would be an example that I think would bear out, you know, what you're saying. But all that I'm saying here, and we have wandered, but is I think part of what we all need to think creatively about these issues is to be exposed to a broad range of different ideas. I don't know if you're aware of the research. I'm going to talk a little bit later in the semester about it, but if you want to look at social pathology like crime and early teenage pregnancy, failure in school, drug addiction, alcohol use, and so on, these correlate far more closely. And this doesn't guarantee causality, but it suggests causality. Correlate far more closely with whether children have a father growing up than whether they have bad schools, whether they're poor, whether they're black or white or Hispanic, what neighborhood they live in. All of those correlations are weak compared with the correlation, does the child have the advantage growing up of a father? And I'm sure if mothers deserted their kids at the same rates that fathers do, it probably would be worse.
But isn't it interesting that if you hear conversations about these issues and these social problems in many courses at Cornell, you never talk about what's most likely the most serious causal factor, the breakdown of the family. And indeed, you even hear what I think are really silly things, that the shape of the family is purely subjective and kids thrive no matter what. And so what I would suggest is we need to be far more open to really thinking about these issues, and we need to hear more voices from different points of view. You're not hearing it at Cornell. It's really tragic because your education at Cornell is a very narrow-gauged education when it comes to some of these really important social issues. And that's understandable because the faculty is so totally lopsided in departments where it matters. If you go to government or some departments in human ecology or INLR or some of the psychology and so on, you have an extraordinarily lopsided faculty. And there's no attempt made to change that. Is that too harsh? Is that... You're all looking very serious. I don't know. Yeah?
I just wonder, when you say that the problem is the breakdown of the family, how do you suggest that you fix that?
Well, I'm not saying that's the problem. I think it's one of the chief problems. Obviously, economics and education and all of these things are critically important. I think one thing we need to do is expand on the brainwashing that we've gotten through television and the media and so on. Intact marriages are extremely important to the success of children. And it's simply untrue that you can have children in all kinds of strange family relationships, very often without fathers involved, that they'll thrive. They don't. Individuals might in some cases, because they're tough and they'll thrive no matter what. But I was divorced when my kids were 3 and 5, and it's had a huge impact on them. Even though I tried very, very hard to counter it. So I think part of what we need to do is, for instance, we need to re-stigmatize men getting women pregnant and then abandoning them. That's an awful thing to do. A lot of you may not know that 85% of abortions in America today are pushed not by the woman but by the man involved. They don't want to take responsibility. Most of the women feel abandoned, and abortion is not their choice. It's not their first choice. It's something they accept because they feel trapped, because the men aren't taking responsibility for what they've done. Well, why don't we talk about those issues? It's a very important issue. It has a huge amount to do with how kids are growing up. And I don't know. Any last comments?
It's fun being old, and it's fun being near retirement, because
occasionally you say what you think. Bad if people don't like it. Because you really want to speak the truth as you see it, always admitting you may be wrong. I was wrong in my last lecture to speak of the first settlers come over 200 years ago. Any other comments? Yes?
Don't you think, would you say people think that like the breakdown of the family structure is one of the biggest problems that we face, but don't you think that those are
They are linked, but I don't think they're caused simply by that. In other words, the causal factors are complex. So yes, of course, poverty is a factor. Our welfare structure is a factor. There are all kinds of factors. But what I'm simply suggesting is don't deal just with economic and educational issues. And in fact, we're not even dealing with educational